I'm your host, Jenny Worthington, and the following interview is from my series, Giving Animals a Voice, Bridging the Gap Between Human and Animal Consciousness.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to my retreat, Giving Animals a Voice, Bridging the Gap Between Human and Animal Consciousness. I am so excited to bring to you today my incredible guest, Eugene Linden, who is a world-traveling animal lover, an award-winning author, and has incredible stories to share with us today about his animal encounters and the stories of people that he's seen and worked with who have their own stories to tell. Welcome, Eugene.
I'm delighted to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your background, because I know it's pretty incredible. You've done some extensive traveling to the remotest places on the planet and have some pretty incredible experiences.
Well, where to begin? Well, after college, I ended up in Vietnam, which is a story in itself, as a investigative journalist towards the end of the war. And I really hadn't been anywhere before I went to Vietnam, but I went around the world to get there and back. and it gave me a taste for travel in a way. It's a separate story, but when I got back, what I'd written about got a fair amount of attention about the war. And I was invited to do a book. And I didn't want to write about the war. I felt I had what I needed to say in the article I wrote. But I'd heard of experiments trying to teach language to chimpanzees. And they were just beginning at those. Well, I guess some of them were well underway. And so a publisher came to me and I said, I don't want to write about the war, but I want to write about that. Out of that came a book called Apes, Men, and Language. And it was about the experiments trying to teach language to chimpanzees in the 60s and 70s, and the controversy surrounding the experiments. And to set the context, back then, the conventional wisdom was that basically animals were little more than wind-up toys, with no ability to think or anything like that. Just problem solve. It was all innate. So it was a time when there was very little acceptance in the scientific community of the idea that animals might possess symbolic abilities or abilities to understand symbols, sentences, things like that. I wrote that book and it got a fair amount of attention. But it was a subject that was fraught with controversy. And what I'm leading up to is how I got from there to the books that and the stories that you're talking about. Because I wrote a couple more books and a lot of articles about attempts to understand animal intelligence, the human and animal, the animal and human. I grew very frustrated with the whole debate. It was sort of like Groundhog's Day, the movie with Bill Murray, where like people would just keep revisiting the same thing over and over and over again and with never any progress, because the problem is that some of these issues are insoluble. I mean, intelligence and language are ill-defined. We don't really have real definitions of them. After 3,000 years of trying, which gives you an idea that they're so profoundly human, and yet we don't know what they are. And to some degree, it's subjective also. Mm-hmm. And subjective abilities, there's always ambiguity whether when an animal, the classic story was Washoe the chimp signing Waterbird when she saw a swan on a lake. Does that mean that she was combining two words in her vocabulary to describe this bird? Or was she just saying water and bird? And there's no way of proving one thing or the other. And that debate about what she meant with that simple description went on for over 40 years. Probably still isn't solved today. In any case, I grew frustrated with the whole insoluble nature of trying to fit into the hard demands of double-blind testing and empiricism, something as subjective as language and intelligence. And in any case, some years later, I was doing a big story for National Geographic on apes and humans, basically the ape and human, the human and ape. And I was traveling with Jane Goodall, and we went to visit Gombe, but along on the trip was a guy named Jeff Creswell, who'd been a zookeeper, and he told me a story about an orangutan named Fu Manchu at the Omaha Zoo. And this orangutan had escaped from his cage, and the keepers had no idea how he was getting out, and he did it three times before he was caught. And they figured it out. What happened was that one of the keepers, who had a very good relationship with Fu, as he was called, saw that he had a bulge in his lip, and he pulled back the lip, and there was, what was it? It was a piece of wire, and he'd used the wire to pick the lock on his cage and escape, but he also knew to hide the wire because he knew the keepers would take it away. And I thought, wow, this is amazing, because one of the critiques of animal intelligence experiments was that the keepers somehow cued the animals to the right answer. Here was a case where the animal was hiding what he was doing from the keeper in order to be able to do it again. And so I thought, gee, maybe animals are best thinking to the degree that they can think when it serves their purposes and not some dumb experimenter trying to write a PhD. And so I began collecting these stories about credible stories about things that animals have done that suggest some degree of problem-solving, awareness, metacognition, all these different higher mental abilities. And I was just flooded with stories, many of them coming from the same scientists who were writing or trying to design these experiments, because they were frustrated as well, because they knew there was something going on in the animal's head, and they were just having a horrible time trying to prove it. And so out of that came this book, The Parrot's Lament. And we, you know, we got stories of betrayal, greed, larceny, all these different, you know, there's a lot of deception going on in the animal kingdom. And there, a lot of them were very funny, and but they were all credible. And a lot of them defy any explanation other than the fact that these animals are thinking. I'll get to a couple of stories, but I want to finish the story on Fu. Well, anyway, that book did very well. And of course, I was invited to write a sequel, and I wanted to too, because I wanted to go deeper into this stuff. But what I didn't know until after I'd finished The Parrot's Lament was that there was more to the story about Fu Manchu than I'd originally been told. And one of the things was that, where did Fu get the wire? The way the setup in the zoo was structured, there was a separate isolation unit when they needed to separate one of the orangutans from the other. And one of these, a female orangutan, whose name was Heavy Lamar, because I guess she was fat, she was like isolated from the other orangutans so they could put her on a diet for her own good. And she was ravenous. Now, what happens in zoos is also happens in prisons. There's a lot of trading back and forth between the animals, and I'll get to some stories about that in a minute. But in any case, in Fu Manchu was seen basically passing monkey biscuits through the wire to Heavy Lamar. Now, why was he giving her that? Well, in her cage, or enclosure, I guess, was a lamp or a lighting fixture, I guess, but the wire had been stripped from the lighting fixture. And so it seems, I mean, you know, this is a case for Columbo, but it seems that maybe Heavy had taken the wire and offered it to Fu Manchu for a monkey biscuit. And so it's highly likely he traded to get the wire, because that's the only source of the wire. And so then the question becomes, did she just desperately look around for something to give him for a monkey biscuit? Or did Fu Manchu actually point to the lighting fixture and say, bring me, somehow in orangutan speak, bring me that wire? We'll never know the answer to that one. But what it does show is the intricate ability to think ahead once he had the wire, and to know also that he needed to conceal it. Now, more prison trading stories. well, I shouldn't call them prisoners because my people who care for these orangutans are absolutely devoted to them. But in any case, Lynn Miles did an experiment trying to teach Chantek a token language, a language. And she had a system of rewards. When he did something well, she was basically trying to teach him money. He could clean up his room and he would get like a poker chip that he would, let's see, what would he do? He could then spend that on a treat or something like that. So he would, you know, happily using this system. And then he decided, gosh, I'm running out of poker chips. So he started splitting them in half and then offering Lynn half a poker chip. In other words, he discovered inflation. So then she's decided enough of this, and they started using a hard coin, which he could not split in half. So then he would start taking pieces of tin foil from gum wrappers and things like that, and he fashioned them into coin-like things, which, and so he discovered counterfeiting as well. So the point is that, you know, these animals are very, very smart. There's a lot of orangutan stories. At a rehabilitation center in in Borneo, there was a orangutan, Unyil, who would use, she was separated from a food trough, which was out of her reach, where they would put the vegetables that would then be distributed to the orangutan. And what she managed to do was she would pluck orangutans with very long hair. And she'd learned how to tie shoelaces, by the way. She'd been rescued from a family and she was quite smart in the death. And she would pull out a long hair and tie it to another hair and tie it to another hair and create a rope. And then she attached that. Now, what was it she attached it to? It might have been to a stick. But in any case, she would throw the stick out and snag the vegetables and was stealing. And this went on for quite a while because the head keeper was accusing the staff of stealing the fruits and vegetables and eating themselves. And it was an orangutan who was pulling off the scam. So it extends far beyond, orangutans. Let's choose another. All right, so this is a story. This is way back when. It was SeaWorld, and Orky was, they hoped to have him, Orky and Corky were the two orcas, Corky being the female. And they wanted them to mate and have a baby, and they did have a baby. But the baby did not thrive. And at one point, they had to remove her, the baby from the tank. And the way they did that, it was they lower a stretcher into the tank and then they put the, maneuver the baby onto the stretcher and they pull it out. They gave the baby a treatment, and then with bringing it back, but the boom operator didn't have a clear line of sight to the level of the tank. And so he halted the stretcher above the tank and the keepers were below and couldn't reach up to it. To the stretcher, and it got worse because the baby started vomiting through its blowhole, and it could have gotten a fatal case of pneumonia. And so it was a desperate situation. Now, Orky's watching this keepers in the water, treading water, trying to reach up, and realized he couldn't reach it. So he went down under them, allowed them to stand on his back, and then lifted them up so that they could release the latch on the stretcher and drop the baby in so that they could, you know, prevent it from aspirating the vomit. He realized that there was something, it was a desperate situation. Humans could help. He could help the humans. And that's extraordinary.
It is.
And then, but that's an orca with an enormous brain. And then another story has to do with Harriet the leopard. And leopards, I once asked a biologist, do you think leopards are smart? And the biologist said, it was a wildlife biologist. He said, no, why should it be? They'd be smart. They're perfect. And I understand what he meant by that. You know, it's a perfectly designed predator. They're incredibly adaptable. They except for hunting, do well, even with humans around. They learn the ropes, all that sort of thing. So anyway, in India, there was a well-known conservationist who would basically had raised this leopard, Harriet, from being a cub and returned it to the wild. He actually helped teach Harriet to hunt, and Harriet's return to the wild was successful. But then a year or so later, and so successful, in fact, that she had a couple of cubs. There were major floods, and her den was threatened, and the cubs were not old enough to leave the den. So what Harriet did was pick up the cubs, and she'd been wild for a couple of years at this point, swim across the river, and bring the cubs up to the second floor of Singh's house, and the conservationist's house, and deposit them in the kitchen of the house, all three of them, instead of a wild leopard coming into the house. In other words, on the high ground. So then the floods eventually receded, and you know, the staff and everybody else were overjoyed. I mean, they were terrified and overjoyed at the same time, and sort of gave the leopard a lot of space, gave Harriet a lot of space, and eventually the floods subsided, and Harriet swam back to check out her den. Came back again, and this time took up one of the cubs. But this time, instead of swimming with the cub across the river, because the river was still very high and rough, hopped into Billy Singh's boat and got into the prow of the boat and looked back over her shoulder. And he had, years ago, he would take her out for paddles. So she'd realized that this was a safer way to get her cubs back across the river. You know, and this is a leopard. And so it shows that, you know, it was my prejudice as well, that you're more likely to find signs of intelligent behavior in the bigger brained animals, the really highly social animals, the animals like the great apes and the dolphins and the whales and the elephants. But this was a kind of problem solving and analytical ability in an animal with not a particularly large brain. It's already perfect, doesn't need it. And so one of the things that's happened over the last decades or so has been that I've overcome that prejudice as well, or tried to, because I shared it and started discovering stories with all sorts of animals, octopus, for instance. And the octopus is a true enigma for the study of intelligence. And I'll say why. One is that, one, it's a mollusk. It's a relative of the clam. Mm-hmm. And clams are not very smart. All of the places where you look for ability, and highly intelligent abilities, are animals with long childhoods in order to bring, to enable them to do the learning. Strong relationships with their parents. Complex social structures, which require an ability, you know, what we call Machiavellian thinking, things like that. Octopus and long lives, because you don't invest in intelligence if an animal isn't going to amortize that over a long period of time. Octopus violates every single one of those things. They're very short-lived. Even the biggest ones only live about 5 years. They're on their own from the get-go. They're just as soon eat another octopus as socialize with it. They don't form complex social relationships. And yet, they do some really smart things. They're incredible escape artists. They have a terrific eye. They employ multiple strategies in hunting, and trying to open, because they eat other mollusks, prying open a clam, for instance, or drilling through it or severing the muscle, they have this ability to change color, chromatophores, chromatophore system in a 30th of a second. So they have to make, they're equipped for fast, flexible decision making. Then the other thing about an octopus is not only is it not big brain, although relative to a mollusk, it's a huge brain. You know, like some 40% of its neurons are in the tentacles, not in the brain where the brain would be. So it just is a real anomaly, and it's sort of, and the octopus has also been around for hundreds of millions of years in various shapes or forms. So it has been optimized by nature to do what it does. But all right, so they seem to recognize individual people, form relationships with them. Jean Ball, who studied octopus, she had some California mudflat octopus, and what she would do in feeding time, she'd give them shrimp, and she'd give one to an octopus, give one to the next octopus, one to the next octopus, and then give another to the first octopus. Well, she gave a bad shrimp to this one little octopus, and when she came back, the octopus still had the shrimp holding it in its tentacle, and sort of made eye contact with Jean Ball, the scientist, crawled across the bottom of its tank to the drain, and then stuffed the shrimp down the drain. So basically saying, you know, what are you giving me? You know, it's direct. The stories of reverse engineering by octopus are just amazing. Unlatching their tanks, figuring out how to get out. They can crawl through anything. And it's kind of funny. We have an ambivalent relationship with octopus because, you know, I went to this octopus website and half of it was stories of octopus intelligence and the other half was recipes for how to cook octopus. Yeah. So it's like, but I think we can all be excused for eating octopus since octopus eat octopus. but they are intelligent. Now, begin to think, the arguments against widely distributed animal intelligence in the old days were that equipping a brain is like metabolically expensive. There's a trade-off with the muscles. We co-opt a lot of blood supply to the brain that would otherwise go to the muscles. And there's always a balance in nature. Don Griffin, who's one of the pioneers of the study of animal intelligence, was a real radical in this regard. And he would say, I think it's more ecologically efficient to give an animal some capacity for decision-making, however small, than it is to try and hardwire a creature for every eventuality, which you can't do. Now, that was a radical idea 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. He would back then cite the story about bees in Princeton, where the bees do a dance, the honeybees do a dance, it's a waggle dance, it's called, to show where major sources of pollen are, you know. And what these evil scientists did was they took a bunch of bees out into the middle of Carnegie Pond and then released them to fly back to their hive. It turned out that when they did a waggle dance, basically saying where the pollen was, none of the other bees believed them because they were saying there's these pollen in the middle of a lake. Yeah. And so Griffin loved that story. He died some years ago, but because it kind of showed some smidgen of consciousness, you know, at the insect level, you know, not, which, you know, an octopus is Einstein compared to most insects. So this notion that intelligence is widely distributed through the animal kingdom is become much more widely accepted, I think. And I think it's a very different world today about being willing to entertain notions of animal intelligence than it was when I first began writing about it. And I think it's that the science has gotten very clever about demonstrating various aspects of various problem solving abilities and things like that, while avoiding the basic question, you know, about metacognition, symbolic thinking, syntactic communication, all that. And I think, so there's a much more openness now, and certainly the public, you know, and it's sort of odd, like with an issue like climate change, the scientists are way ahead of the public in terms of understanding the threat. I think with this question of animal intelligence, the public is way ahead of the scientists in terms of being open-minded and willing to accept evidence of animal intelligence. And so, you know, the old story was when cats are bringing in a mouse, they're thinking you're a kitten and they're trying to teach you to hunt. The pet owner's interpretation was they don't want to be dependent on you and they're trying to contribute to the larder. And, you know, I think you can be today more open to that explanation than that they think you're a big stupid kitten and they're trying to teach you to hunt. Because we feed them, we clearly know how to hunt. I think it's a much more rich world with, you know, when you can think of all these minds around you, surrounding, scheming, doing different things that we do, you know, deceiving others. And there's just endless stories in the ape community of attempts to, you know, pretend there are no bananas where they know there are bananas there. I had a story where in Borneo at a rehabilitation center in Borneo, where an orangutan was just sort of hanging out and around around one of the staff quarters, and when they went out to dinner, the orangutan had apparently a hole in the ceiling, went in and stole all the food, and then went back out. So that's metacognition. It was understanding that the young female, that the people need to clear out if she was going to carry off the scheme. One other story about an orangutan rehabilitation center. At this one place, there's an orangutan named Siti, and the rehabilitation center had the main center, and then they had a halfway house, where the orangs, once they were able to show that they could feed themselves, they sort of try them out in this area for a little while before releasing them into the wild. And while they were in the halfway house, they weren't supposed to be being fed. They were supposed to be able to fend for themselves. That was the whole point. So anyway, couple of donors were visiting this halfway house, and they wanted to show how Siti could feed herself. And what orangutans can do is you take a coconut and it has a soft part, you know, what would look like eyes, and you can poke through there and break it open, get the milk or whatever. But before she'd been brought there, what they do taught to do this, people would split a coconut with a machete and then hand it to the orangutan. So the donors were there, and the CD's keeper was there, and he handed her coconut, and she handed it back to him. He handed it to her again, and she handed it back to him. And so finally, when he handed it to her a third time, she found a stick, picked up a stick, and mimed chopping it with a machete, which busted him totally because it showed that he'd been cheating and splitting the coconuts for her. But it also showed that she was pretty damn smart. The writing about the experiments in animal intelligence is a bit like writing about the Arab peace talks in Egypt. You know, I mean, it's just you're just hyper vigilant and careful. Mm-hmm. Writing about these stories that I did in the octopus and the orangutan was really just liberating and really fun, and I got a big response. So.
Yeah, they're beautiful stories. I wanted to ask you, just based on, sorry to interrupt you, but based on like animal brain size, I mean, birds are such an incredible example of that, like the parrots and the macaws. And, you know, I mean, it's got to be part of it. It's got to be just the size of the animal, you know, relative to the size of the brain.
Right. Well, it... keep in mind, if you have to fly, everything is on weight, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the best example of this, I think, is that, you know, look at dolphins and whales. They basically live in a zero gravity environment. And so, except for the costs of food, I mean, there's no penalty for putting on weight. And they can grow a very big brain with infinitely less cost than it is for a bird. And so it's not just the size of the brain, it's how it's wired. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a mammal that uses sonar in ways almost as sophisticated as a dolphin, and that's a bat. But a bat has a tiny brain because it cannot afford a bigger brain metabolically. It couldn't fly. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know that anybody has done anything in terms of studying bat intelligence, but with birds, it's the same thing. Like the macaws and the parrots, live in incredibly complex social situations. Mm-hmm. And they too have to understand not only the environment what's good to eat and what's not, but also who's up, who's down, you know, how do I relate to this person? How do I relate to that? Or this parrot, I guess. So I think, and then the other thing, we'll get to this final point here in a sec, is that bird song, when you're within earshot, to maintain genetic coherence, birds have to come up a song that the right bird will hear and mate, and not another bird will hear and mate, if they have an adaptation for a particular niche, right? And often they're within earshot. And so they have this rampant adaptation going on with birdsong, constantly changing. And that's, you know, and so they have, you know, parrots particularly equipped to learn different sounds, not just generate sounds. Now, one of the ideas that I found particularly attractive is that, you know, let's say intelligence is widely distributed through the animal kingdom. Let's sort of say that. And how is that so? And so where does it come from? And one of the thought is that maybe intelligence is a byproduct of basically utilitarian adaptations. For the octopus, for instance, it needs to do this fast. It needs to interpret visual information very rapidly and make decisions about that, what strategy to deploy. So maybe the byproduct, the thing that comes with that, is some small degree of consciousness, some small degree of decision-making ability. And that permits them to do things like tell Gene Ball, I don't like this shrimp, right? And with the parrot, you know, again, it's got this very elastic, you know, acoustic and generative abilities. And so it can learn words. And, you know, as Irene Pepperberg has shown, you know, it knows what they mean. Mm-hmm. Not only that, it knows, you know, it understands syntax. This ecologically surplus ability, I think, is a powerful idea that intelligence may, and in our case as well, may have originated in things that were really survival oriented, and, you know, not to write Shakespeare, but to basically, you know, get dinner on the table or avoid being eaten, or maybe cooperate in order to get something to eat, because it becomes addictive. Now, this is the thing. Our intelligence goes back a long time, you know, a couple of million years. We began to differentiate in intellectual abilities, you know, probably over a million, maybe 2 million years ago from our ape cousins. And as our groups got more complex, you get addicted to it. In other words, as a trade-off for the muscles, you sort of need to cooperate to hunt. You need to do things to survive, mm-hmm. Because you're no longer as strong as your other competitors. that happened in Homo sapiens is a couple hundred thousand years old, right? So our base, the real growth in human intelligence took place in a couple hundred thousand, the real skyrocketing that makes our brain so much bigger relative to the other apes. Organized brains have been around 600-700 million years. And my thought, which would have been ridiculous, would have been received 50 years ago, but now I think is highly likely, is that who's to say that some other intelligent creature with our level of intelligence hasn't come and gone over the 600 million feet? Think, if we had disappeared 20,000 years ago, a million years from now, no one would ever know that a highly intelligent species had ever inhabited the planet, because we would have left no trace except for the, in a million years, who knows whether the caves of Lascaux would still persist. My most recent book was this novel, Deep Past. And in this, the plot of the novel is exactly that. I hypothesize the discovery of an intelligence that flowered and came and went 5 million years ago. I'm often asked, you know, like, how do you think that's possible? And not only do I think it's possible, I think it's probable. Mm-hmm. But we won't know, because they would, unless they created a material culture like ours, we would never know. Mm-hmm. And by the way, there are not many aspects of culture that would last 5 million years anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I think I've covered everything I wanted to cover. Is that all right?
It was fantastic. And I just can't get enough of those stories. I think they're really amazing.
And they're fun.
Yeah. And I absolutely believe that, you know, these human stories of their interactions with animals are way ahead of the scientific community trying to study something that, you know, is really hard to quantify anyway.
Well,
you
need to be able to define it to quantify it. And what you can do is quantify subsets of it, but you can't quantify what intelligence is.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think of something like sarcasm, you actually are saying something that means the opposite, but it is syntactically, it is, and symbolically, it's the exact same sentence. It's just tone of voice. And so if some percentage of meaning comes from tone of voice or facial expression or eye contact, you know, isolating the syntax from that in terms of the meaning is sort of like, you know, taking the visible part of an iceberg as the whole iceberg, when everything else is, you know, the information is. And like one thing about human communication, a good deal of the time in communicating with somebody you haven't met before is finding a common vocabulary, mm-hmm. even if you speak the same language, finding a mutual set of understanding, so you know the context for which this communication is and what the other person is believing and seeing in it. And it underscores the fact that all of these higher mental abilities occur in a social context. In my novel, Deep Past, one of the subplots is that this woman scientist makes this discovery, but she has plenty of difficulties, you know, just staying alive. But one of her difficulties in making it known is having it published in a believable way in a scientific journal. Mm-hmm. And the way, what you see there is that is, you know, it's not what you discover. It's not what you know. It's who believes that you know something, you know, and if it's mainstream science they don't believe that you know something, you might as well, you know, you're consigned to cryptozoology or whatever else. So the importance of that notion that intelligence and all our higher mental abilities prefer take place in a social context is really key. And again, that also makes the octopus so interesting, because its intelligence does not occur in a social context,
except
when it's interacting with us.
It's incredible. Well, they're fantastic stories, and I so appreciate your coming on. And I encourage everybody who's listening to check out Eugene's books, The Parrot's Lament, The Octopus and the Orangutan, Deep Past, and what was the other one I was reading? Was
The Ragged Edge of the World.
The Ragged Edge of the World. I mean, they're really amazing, and they're just incredible stories. And thank you so, so much for
my pleasure. Thank you. Enjoyed the conversation.
Taking the time.
Thank you for listening to Hello Animal Talks, hosted by me, Jenny Worthington. Production by Stacy Spencer of Going Graphic. Sound engineered by Jimmy Richards of Bay Central Media. And music written and performed by Jake Shepard.